You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX Today starts with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including an earthquake in California yesterday, more troubles with school funding, and another proposed district in Ashland where repeat offenders could be banned. I'm Liam Moriarty, JPR's interim news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
Greetings, people.
Good morning.
Hello.
Justin, most of our listeners likely received an alert yesterday about an earthquake. Tell us about that. What happened?
Yeah, that alert actually went out to around 500,000 people, according to USGS. So
startled the heck out of a lot of us, too.
Yeah, scarier than the earthquake itself. So that was pretty incredible. People as far north as Lincoln City, Oregon, got it, as well as far south as Salinas in California. And in the office here, we kind of took a minute, like I'm sure most people that received the alert, and tried to see if we could sense any shaking. A plant did move slightly on our desk. I'm not sure if that was in our imagination.
No, that was a tremor.
Real?
That was
okay.
A tremor, man.
Yeah, so it wasn't the big one. We're on along the Cascadia Fault here. There eventually will happen, but it was a big one. It was a pretty big earthquake. This was measured at a 7.0, and that's pretty significant. It occurred off the coast of Northern California, about 45 miles southwest of Eureka on a coastal fault line. So it happened in the ocean. And just by comparison, around the same area was struck by a magnitude 6.4 quake in 2022, and that left thousands of people without power for a while and water and damaged some buildings. This earthquake was 8 times stronger than that. So the earthquake Richter scale thing isn't linear. So there's a very big difference between a 6.0 and a 7.0, which I didn't know. And the USGS gave a press conference and said that this was a relatively big earthquake. And although this region around Humboldt County and off the coast is very seismically active, the earthquakes, aren't rare. This was relatively big. Here's Stephen DeLong with the USGS.
This is an area in Northern California that's highly tectonically active. And this area is more generally known as the Mendocino Triple Junction. This is a place where the Cascadia Subduction Zone, the Mendocino Fault, and the San Andreas Fault all come together.
So we mentioned the Cascadia subduction zone there, and that's the fault line that runs around 600 miles along the coast from Northern California all the way up to Canada. So this area sees a lot of earthquakes, which I'm sure people who live here are aware of.
Well, and because it was in the ocean, there was a tsunami warning too, which got everybody's attention. A lot of people had to head for the hills, but no tsunami actually materialized, right?
Right. Yeah, that was the big danger. No tsunami happened. That with an earthquake this size, that was what people were worried about. And I learned just recently, actually, in reporting a different story about Crescent City's history with tsunamis. Since 1933, they've had 32 tsunamis. And a few of those have actually caused considerable damage and loss of life. That didn't happen, luckily, this time. I was checking in with the harbor master in Crescent City. And he said the water rose about half a foot and then went back down in the span of about 5 minutes. But he did say people headed for the hills. They took it really seriously, as they should, and there was a mass evacuation. That brief tsunami warning was in effect for around 5 million people along the West Coast. So much more people received that warning than, possibly felt the earthquake. And even down in San Francisco, for example, people were kind of watching the beach to see if anything would roll in. But luckily that warning was canceled after barely an hour, so no tsunami.
Fingers crossed. Reports of any significant damage?
So far, no. We're not seeing any reports. I'm kind of browsing social media and seeing if anyone's reported something, but there's mostly just pictures of things that have fallen off shelves and stores, lots of videos of people's pool water slushing around, So far, no significant damage, and that's very good. Around 9,000 people did lose power in Humboldt County. I checked this morning, and all of those outages were restored. Though officials did say aftershocks will occur in the coming days, that's normal. Here's Christine Goulet with the USGS.
The general concept is that earthquakes are expected following a large one, such as a 7, that's a major earthquake. They'll decrease in intensity and what people feel, and in frequency over time.
So those aftershocks will continue for a while, but the intensity will go down. We're not expecting another 7.0. But there's still a possibility for damage from those aftershocks, especially if something's been damaged from the first earthquake, so possibly weakened after that initial earthquake. California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency for Humboldt, Del Norte, and Mendocino counties. But we'll be checking in today and this morning to see if there's any damage, especially in some of those really rural areas along the Northern California coast. If any listeners experience damage, feel free to reach out through our website and let us know.
Great. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it. Jane, you attended a meeting last night for the Ashland School District, kind of a community listening session about the budget. What's going on there?
So the Ashland School District is in sort of a precarious financial situation, which I've done some reporting on before. The news now is that if nothing changes, if they don't do anything, they are on track to have a fund balance of over negative a million dollars at the end of this current fiscal year, the fiscal year we're currently in. They also don't have enough money to cover their expenses through October, so, you know, almost a year from now. And they need to save almost $2.8 million in cash to get the district to November of 2025. So they have had a series of listening sessions for staff and for the community to provide updates and let people give suggestions and ask questions.
For a district this size, that seems like a pretty big hole. How did they get here?
Yeah, so Ashland is not alone in these types of struggles. I did some reporting on this earlier this year. There are a lot of districts in the state that are struggling with financial issues for a lot of different reasons. Inflation, there's increased special education needs and all these sort of things. But Ashland is the one who is talking about changing their budget mid-year. We're in the middle of a fiscal and school year, and they need to change their budget to save $1 million by the end of the fiscal year. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Obviously, not enough revenue, and their expenses are too high. They've had declining enrollment, as many districts had. So Ashland currently has about 300 fewer students now than it did in 2017, which correlates with less money from the state. And there's a lot of reasons for that. People blame COVID or the 2020 wildfires. There are a lot of reasons for declining enrollment. But the thing that's interesting about Ashland School District is that their enrollment has declined, but their staffing has increased. And so part of it is that they have so many staff. So Ashland chose to spend its COVID money, the federal COVID relief money that it got, to hire over 70 new full-time staff to help maintain operations and social distancing and help with kids had more behavioral needs. The problem with that is that that is not a one-time fixed cost, and that's expensive. You need to pay for salaries and health insurance and all the things that come with, sure, with staff. Other districts spent it on HVAC systems and things like that. That's a one-time cost and it's done. And so that choice has really caught up with the district. They had thought there would be more attrition, more people leaving, but people have stuck around, and now they have all these new staff. And again, they have 300 fewer students than they did in 2017. They did lay off some staff last school year to help address this budget crisis, but really they've got just a lot of staff, maybe more than they really need or can afford. And one thing I thought was interesting is they were talking about some fund balances last night, and their ESSER money, which is the COVID relief money. That fund is projected at the beginning of this year was at almost negative $800,000. And so I was asking the superintendent, you only get X amount of money from the federal government. How can you be in the negative? And basically they've overspent on their staffing from that federal COVID money, and now they have to pay back almost $800,000.
And that's a part of that 2.2 plus million that we were talking about total?
Yeah, there's a lot of numbers. It's kind of complicated. They're going to be in the negative of over $1 million at the end of this year, and then they also need to raise almost $2.8 million to get to November.
Gotcha. So what solutions is the district looking at?
So there's a new superintendent. His name is Joseph Hattrick. He started in July, so he's really just sort of inherited this problem. The previous superintendent, Samuel Bogdanov, has retired. And they're talking about a lot of different things. They've already implemented a spending freeze, and then they need to figure out, obviously, how to reduce expenses, how to save money, how to increase their revenue. Superintendent Hattrick was saying that he would ideally like to save about $2.2 million this year. They really only need about $1 million, but he would like to have some wiggle room in case something happens. And they're really talking about anything and everything on the table, potentially closing schools, selling properties, reducing staffing. Do we reduce the number of days in the school calendar? Do we cancel some courses? Do we eliminate field trips? So this is all preliminary. They haven't made a decision yet. They're still gathering, you know, feedback. They've talked about maybe taking out a big loan to get that $2.8 million to get them to November. So ongoing discussions, but it doesn't seem like anything is really off the table.
So what happens next?
So Superintendent Hattrick has been doing all these listening sessions, getting feedback and suggestions. And so he's going to present proposals to the Ashland School Board on Thursday, December 12th. And so the school board will be the one to make the final decision of what to do. There'll probably be multiple different things that are happening to help address this problem. But here's Superintendent Hattrick. He seems pretty optimistic.
It's what I signed up for. I mean, I have had success with dealing with this, not to this extent, but I'm confident that as a community we can solve it together.
So yeah, he's worked in other school districts before that have had financial problems. He recognizes it's not a happy subject and it will be difficult, but he thinks the district can get through it. And he also would like to be able to get the district to a point where they have a contingency fund, so some extra money as padding, but that might be a little ways off,
I would think. Thanks, Jane. Appreciate it. Justin, back to you. You also reported this week on a new Enhanced Law Enforcement Area, or ELEA, in Ashland. What's that?
Yeah, so an enhanced law enforcement area is actually something the city's had for over a decade now. It was created in 2012. The current zone is located in an area downtown. And what that means is that if someone is convicted in Ashland Municipal Court for three or more crimes or violations within a six-month period within that border, they can be banned for up to a year from entering the area. So if police catch a repeat offender, then they could actually be arrested. It's a law that I didn't know existed. The target for this seems to be those that repeatedly commit a kind of, you know, usually nuisance crimes like drinking in public, littering, having their dog off leash. And according to police, they've found that it's the same people that keep on committing these offenses. Last year, there were 105 violations in Ashland's downtown enforcement zone, which led to 9 expulsions. Ashland Police Chief Ty O'Mara told the city council this week that this policy has worked to an extent downtown. He saw a high of violations in 2017, and then it came down and has remained pretty steady. But while that's happened, different areas of Ashland have seen an increase in violations and crime. So he wants to expand this policy to another area, and the city council voted in favor of that this week. The new area, we have a map of this on our site, it's pretty big. It runs along Ashland Street, starting at Siskiyou Boulevard, and goes all the way to the freeway. And it includes this business kind of district where there's that Rite Aid and Albertsons and Shopping Cart. City Council member Jeff Dale said this ordinance was needed to stop an uptick in crime in that area.
The fact of the matter is that this area of Ashland for quite some time has seen a disproportionate increase in behavior that is not conducive to a healthy community. And the responsible thing to do is take some active action to mitigate this trend.
So there's some exceptions to this ordinance if you're banned from an area but need to get to work, or if you're buying like basic supplies or visiting a pharmacy or getting medical care, then you can still enter the area. So presumably you need to prove to police you're doing something like that. Also, the list of violations that can get you banned doesn't include prohibited camping. So the police chief was very explicit that this isn't meant to remove homeless people. It's just to stop bad behavior.
So some members of the public spoke out against the ordinance at the council meeting. What are the criticisms of the law?
Well, some worry it'll still target homeless, even though the laws that it doesn't include prohibited camping. It could still target low income people too. That's a worry. Some also worry that the effect of the law may be to push people from that area into neighboring districts. I think just the idea that the city can make public areas off limits to resident doesn't sit well with some people, even if they have a criminal history. There's also, that's all I have there.
That's all you have there. And is Ashland unique in having these areas? Do other places have these?
We're not, actually. Medford has one. It's called the Civil Exclusion Zone. That's located downtown. That only requires one offense from a list of crimes for a ban of 90 days. And the city council actually voted in favor of more than doubling that zone size in September. Eugene also had something similar. And from what I can tell, it looks like they don't have that anymore. But back in 2012, the ACLU of Oregon wrote something opposed to it. They argued it violated people's due process. So it's interesting to see if other localities, other towns around us will expand theirs as well. And we'll be checking in on that.
Excellent. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it. And that's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things you think we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at igpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.